listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Hi, everyone. It's the Tennis.com podcast. Back, Steve Tigner and myself, Ed McGrogan, took one of our extended holiday breaks. I would say on our behalf on the podcast is obviously long overdue to get back into the swing of things here. And obviously the 2016 season is pretty much upon us. Today is December 29th, and you know balls will be hit at pro tournaments in just a few days. There's a lot of preview work on the website on tennis.com, of course, and we've discussed players individually many times. We'll have coming some various roundtable questions that we put to various editors and writers. So check those out as the new year begins. And I think this podcast, Steve, I'd like to really talk about just some more overall themes of the 2016 season. Is it a continuation? I think this is a question perhaps that we have for every season, is that at the end of every year, it's almost hard to think of something changing the status quo of the previous season. And we've really been asking that question for a long time on both tours. The men and the women have really been, ruled by a very select few players. I mean, overall, as you enter this new year, before we get into some specific things, are you kind of, how do you think about that as we enter 2016?
Yeah, I think, when you imagine this year, you don't see it. It's hard to imagine it as a transitional year or anything really new happening or a new group of players appearing. I think you look at it as, at least at the very top, you look at it, you have to think it's going to continue as it was, especially on the men's side with Djokovic. He just seems so solid at number one without, the fact that his main challenger is going to be 35 this year. And there's really nobody, Djokovic is one of the younger guys in the top 10. Just that fact alone makes you think it's really hard to imagine a big shift. We've looked for one for years and one hasn't come. Now it almost seems like it's not worth really speculating about any changes or changing of the guard happening on the men's side. The women's is maybe a little more, Serena is as dominant as Djokovic, but maybe there's a little more flux there possible within the top 10. Last year you felt like the top 10 was struggling a lot. It was sort of unclear as to who really was there after Serena. We'll see if that can be shored up and whether Serena can continue the way she has been. I think it's going to be more difficult for her than it is for Djokovic for the simple reason she's 5 years older. So maybe there's a little more of a possibility of something different, some new winners on the women's side.
I think when it comes to transitions and more of the better word, maybe just really changes and I think this specifically relates to Serena is, you can never really see it coming, but once it happens, that it has happened and there's no question about it that something has altered. I really kind of compare it to other sports we've seen, look at like Peyton Manning, for example, in the NFL and how it really doesn't seem like that long ago that, he's throwing 50 touchdowns. He's still a top five pick in fantasy. And, now Peyton looks, and this has a lot to do with, it has a lot to do with age, of course, injury, but, we would have never predicted something, a fall this deep from a player like that. And I think that goes for teams in various sports and players. And I think that's really, what keeps us in a way kind of glued to sports so much is really this, we think we know everything and it's really our jobs to kind of forecast what we know, what we think we know. But until you really kind of see it all play out, it's largely an unknown, and I think we'll still get inklings of that in 2016. I think for the women's side, someone like Garbine Muguruza perhaps is one that a lot of people have talked about. She is, you know, we're talking about her before this podcast. She'll be continuing on her coaching stint with Sam Sumac. And I think that was a very, you know, there's a lot of players who've changed coaches that we'll be getting into the new season. But for someone like her and Sumac, you know, that perhaps is something that, you know, maybe one of the biggest stories of the year.
Yeah, just thinking about Serena as well, as compared with Djokovic, is I think, you know, just looking at where they are in their careers, I think Djokovic is still really focused on being number one for the foreseeable future. I'm not sure if Serena at this point, if that's as much of a goal or is just getting past Steffi Graf in the slams, winning two more and passing her. I feel like, you know, that may be more of what Serena focuses on. She took that time off at the end of last year. Maybe it's just, I'm going to really do a last push to get past Steffi. You know, that may be the next thing. Whereas Djokovic is just all about all around constant domination. And maybe that'll be, maybe that mindset will be the difference between them. And as far as Muguruza, that's true. We didn't mention her as, unlike the men's side, nobody really rose up at the end of the year the way she did on the women's side, and really is somebody that everybody's looking for as you know, nobody would be surprised if she became the next new slam winner, you know, in the women's side.
Yeah, and like I mentioned with her, you know, she'll be with Sumac in her corner. You know, there are a number of players who, you know, this is one of the talking points as we go into a new year, is various changes in the coaching arrangements of players. One of the bigger ones, you know, on the women's side would have to be Madison Keys and Lindsay Davenport. That seemed like such a natural pairing, and I think that was really just more an effect of Davenport not being able to or wanting to commit to the full time grind of that. She was, you know, Keys was already coached really with Davenport's husband as well, as in sort of a dual capacity there. But where Madison goes, I think certainly she has kind of a wide spectrum where she could land on, depending on really the experience so far of a very young career, but already pretty prosperous in some respects. But there's still, you know, a lot we'll need to see from her week to week, not just at the slams.
Yeah, that's a big one, and that was a surprise. I think they wanted to stay together. Lindsay, you know, from all appearances, it seems that she just couldn't commit to the amount of travel. She has four kids. She and her husband couldn't really commit to being full-time all the time with Madison. I think Madison and Lindsay also felt like she needed somebody there. You know, she wants somebody with her throughout the tour. Jesse Levine is her new coach, and they're friends. You know, it's a different relationship. Lindsay was a mentor and an ex Grand Slam champion, a sort of a super coach. Now she goes to somebody who's more of a contemporary, just a little older than her, somebody she's grown up practicing with and has been friends with. It sort of reminds me of when Andy Murray went, he had Brad Gilbert as his coach and then went to a group, more of a group of guys who were more like contemporaries, more friends of his, more, you know, he felt like he wanted
some camaraderie, you
know, camaraderie on the tour. And maybe, you know, Madison has learned from a slam champ. She probably had more to learn, but here's a different kind of, you know, maybe try a different, a little, maybe something a little more relaxed. And she, you know, she's talked about how she wants to focus on having a really consistent season week to week. She hasn't been able to do that. She's had great results, obviously, in big tournaments, but not week in, week out. She's had injuries. I think she wants, you know, I think maybe she wants somebody who's going to help her, and she's going to want to feel comfortable around all the time, is going to be there all the time, and they can work together to get her more consistent over the course of the year. And, you know, so we'll see. I think it's a big change, and on the surface, you know, it doesn't seem like a great change from Lindsay Davenport to Jesse Levine, who's hasn't really coached anybody, but you never.
Yeah, the one thing that I will say about, you know, a player like Levine, and this really goes for, I think, a number of players who, and you bring up Gilbert, this is, I don't want to compare the two in actual playing accolades and talent, but, you know, when Gilbert went and coached Andre Agassi, it was from a perspective of someone who was recently on the tour, even though this is not the same gender, of course. I think that there is something perhaps to be said about someone who has been immersed in the week to week of just the really what it takes on to grind away at on the tour, you know, the travel that comes with it, just really the lifestyle that you can really only, I think, communicate if you've been there yourself. And I think you've been there fairly recently, which is, you know, the case with Levine there. That, I think, in a way can bring us to where we are with Roger Federer and Ivan Ljubicic. This is something that you brought up, I think alluded to in your piece about the two, is that Ljubicic, the biggest takeaway actually was that, you know, Ljubicic in many respects is seeing the tour from Federer's eyes in a way. He was basically a contemporary of his in the mid 2000s, really. You know, Federer going from Stefan Edberg, you know, one of the many so-called legendary coaches, transitioning to someone with, I think, a much different eye for the game. He also recently coached Milos Raonic last year and has obviously seen and scouted many of the players that Federer has faced for years and will be facing this year. So I think that sort of current recent player dynamic, you know, maybe that's perhaps one of the next sort of trends going on in coaching. But I think it's, you know, it's very interesting to see how Keys will do and how Federer and Ljubicic will do together.
Yeah, I think I think the biggest thing with Federer and Ljubicic, the first thing, you know, I think he wanted to continue with Edberg, but Edberg didn't want to do it, didn't want to keep doing it, hadn't really planned on doing it long term. I think for Federer being 34, having, you know, who knows how much more time on tour, but not a lot. I think of the fact that he knows Ljubicic and he knows him pretty well and he's known him for a long time, that aspect was attractive. He didn't have to build up a new relationship. You know, he already knows this guy pretty well. And I think you're right. I think having played against, it's a whole different thing when a player's played against somebody else. Edberg and Federer were a great combination, but he played a different brand of tennis. You know, played in a different era, he played a different style. Ljubicic is a guy with a big serve, but a baseline game. Not obviously nothing like Federer's talent, but was a smart guy and had to think his way through against a lot of the players that Federer's been playing and will be playing. And I think just the comfort in the relationship and that they won't have to spend too much time getting to know each other, that'll be a big thing. And, you know, we'll see whether Ljubicic has some ideas for especially how to beat Djokovic. It wouldn't seem to, on the surface, he was 2-7 against Djokovic. I think he was 4-14 against the big four for his career. So, you know, we'll see what kind of help he can bring Federer.
Ljubicic is a very insightful guy, too. I think he's a great Twitter follow also. Excuse me. And should be noted that Federer, I believe you probably were at this tournament in Indian Wells when Federer won the title over Ljubicic in the final, beat him with a net cord winner. If I'm not mistaken, this is one of the sort of most deflating championship points I can remember in the Federer era. But he did that. They'll go on, you know, together here. I think the point about Djokovic is pretty interesting. You know, seeing that Ljubicic, of course, has played him. He's got to have some sort of, I think, a bit of a deeper knowledge, too. You have, you know, both of them Eastern European players. So I think that's interesting because really, you know, Djokovic was really the only hurdle that Federer was unable to clear last year. It would have been, really could have been one of his better years in quite some time had Djokovic not, you know, really run over everybody, including Roger there. So, you know, that's going to be really, I think, you know, looked at with a microscope right away to see how that turns out. You know, we'll get into, you know, while we're on the subject of Federer, I think, and we'll still talk about some other coaches here, but, you know, the other big change for Roger was that he's really cut back pretty much all of his clay play in 2016. He will only play Roland Garros on clay. You know, really has put away the training and the grind necessary for the various Masters events, you know, Monte Carlo, Rome, Madrid. That's all gone in favor of more hardcore play, more grass play especially. You know, this has to do with the Olympic schedule this year as well, though. But I think it's a very good call for Federer to do. You know, none of those Masters events are certainly, you know, would be classified as must wins for him at this point in his career. I think they're all really just kind of bonuses and certainly help the ranking, of course. Yeah, you mentioned Serena earlier as someone who is really sort of passing up the week to week play in favor of going for the slams. And I think you can make the comparison to Federer here as well.
Yeah, this is a real sign of, you know, a real shift towards the, you know, into the latter stages of his career. He's pretty much jettisoning the whole part of the season. I don't think he ever would have thought of that as recently as a couple of years ago, but each year it did, you know, in a sense it does make sense. Each year you see him, he would come do pretty well in Australia, make a run at Indian Wells, and then, you know, in the recent time, and then suddenly he'd have to shift over to clay, which really wasn't his, you know, he would make his goals to win Wimbledon. That was his number one goal, and suddenly he had to spend 2 months playing on a completely different surface pretty much right before Wimbledon. So, you know, in that sense, each time the clay season came around, it felt like his season kind of got stuck, you know, lost a lot of the momentum. So now he'll focus on Wimbledon and obviously the Olympics. I'm sure that's what he's working towards and being rested for. We've talked in the past about how people speculated that this tournament in Rio, he would retire after that or retire this year once he'd played one more Olympics. I don't think that's true anymore. I think he's going to continue, but it is a big event for him. You know, it's probably the last Olympics he's going to play.
He's going to go probably, you know, singles, doubles, and mixed. You would think he is going to play with Martin Hingis in the mixed. You know, you have to think at a certain point him and Stan will they'll go for another gold. They are previous gold medal doubles winners in 2008 in Beijing. So that, you know, there's a ton on the plate, you know, for Federer just at that Olympics too.
Yeah, I think that's, but it is interesting that he's making this big shift. He's also going playing a little more on grass. He's going to play in Stuttgart on grass. But yeah, it's putting a lot on Wimbledon and the Olympics. That's for sure for him.
Yeah. And, you know, overall, you know, the Olympics, I think, is such a big part of this 2016 season. I think, you know, we've heard players from Federer to Venus Williams to others really targeting this specific games for such a long time, for years now. It's not like this has crept up on anyone. I think it was seen as a milepost. You mentioned with, you know, would this be Federer's, you know, really last of, you know, was he playing solely to get another shot at a gold medal? It's really the only thing that he hasn't won in his career. You know, Venus has made mention of that too on the women's side, as this was a motivating event to play. She's always done well in the Olympics and has always really targeted things, you know, her career, I think, around them. So I think, in a sense, you know, we've been talking about Rio for quite a long time now, and you know, I think as the year builds on, that's going to be even more pronounced. You're going to be seeing certainly a lot of singles players will be, you know, dabbling in the doubles draws. You know, not, you know, Indian Wells' doubles draw, which is famous for its field, is probably be even, you know, more stocked this year. You'll see it, I think, in some warm-up events, particularly maybe in Toronto and Canada for both tours, which is the tournament that immediately, you know, precedes Rio. And it's just interesting to see where this event, you know, it's it's a far-flung Olympics from where the tours go at that time. It's in South America. It is a hard-court event. You know, you may think that being down there, it's a clay event, but really a lot of the South American tournaments in recent years have shifted over to hard courts, I think by pressures from where the tours calendars are, maybe the tastes of players, but I think also because of this tournament. And, you know, it really just shows, I think, the shadow that the Olympics continues to cast on the tour and on athletes in general. So I think it's a great event. I think 2012's games were particularly memorable for a lot of reasons, and I think this one should be, you know, one of the signature tournaments of 2016.
Yeah, 2012 was the best tennis Olympics yet. Part of that was that it was at Wimbledon. It was at a great location. We'll see what if you know about this one. I think it's almost to the level where it's like it's past a Masters now. You almost feel like it's a sort of a not quite a slam, but it's a tournament unto its own. It's like a slam now. The fact that people are playing singles, doubles, and mixed. Nadal's talking about playing with Muguruza. Federer's going to play with Hingis. It's, you know, the two tours really do this together. It's almost feels like a model for what a Grand Slam could be, you know, going forward. If you look at, you know, if you want to look at something like making them have the men play two out of three, if they're going to play something like doubles and mixed, really, it's almost like an ideal sort of one-week dual-gender event where everybody is together. So yeah, it's going to be it should be great as long as Rio is, you know, everything's ready, everything's good in Rio in general.
Yes, good point with the two out of three sets too. That's always something to remember for the men there. And you know, even though and you still get epics though with it. You know, you remember Federer Del Potro 4 years ago there. So there's lots of good potential for this. Going back to just a couple more of the coaches that we, you know, we could mention here, I think worth mentioning, of course, this has been around for a little while. Both these really have Simona Halep going with Darren Cahill. I think I'm most interested to see just what Cahill brings on a full-time basis. And I think just because, you know, for the sole reason that many of us feel like we know Cahill so well because, you know, he's been talking to us on ESPN for much of the past 5-6 years during the Slams and Masters events. You certainly get a sense of the kind of guy he is, you know, what his philosophies are. We've seen him occasionally when he's done work with Adidas player, you know, the arrangements that he has, and that's how he's, you know, worked with Halep before, but taking this to a full-time position, I think that's one of, you know, really one of the most interesting ones to see. You know, is this perhaps really, you know, a boost that could kind of put Halep to where she needs to be to really finally get that signature win, which I think at this point has to be described as a slam win. The other one you and I were talking about before was, you know, Grigor Dimitrov, someone who, you know, similarly could use kind of a bit of a boost, really a reset button after last year. It just was nothing really had happened for Dimitrov that we were expecting it to. You know, the only thing we thought would happen was that his time with Roger Rashid after a few months of just inconsistent results would kind of run its course. That's exactly what happened. And he takes on Juan Martín Del Potro's former coach, Franco Devine, who, you know, another guy we've seen before, haven't in a while because of Del Potro being out. But, you know, both of those two players, I think, where, you know, perhaps we're not exactly sure where both of those two really end up this year. I think the coaching arrangements in and of themselves are pretty interesting talking points.
Yeah, I think the big question, you know, for Darren or any coach of Halep is how to really get her emotional best from her in every match, because sometimes you get it and sometimes, you know, she'll even admit you don't get it. She can get negative fast. How do you bring that out and help her? You know, obviously, she has the game and the talent really to beat just about anyone. You know, how do you keep her believing in herself, keep her from not being, you know, I think such a perfectionist on court and getting so down if she makes some mistakes. I don't know. I think it's a big challenge. And you know, Cahill, she definitely respects Cahill and has liked what they've done and how they've worked together. So, you know, that's all positive to start. With Dimitrov, he definitely needed somebody new. You know, he needs something new in his game. He seemed like he was going through the motions a lot last year. He finished things with Rashid. He had to break up with Sharapova, which he said affected him. And he just seemed like treading water, really, through most of the year. Not a lot of fire in his game or not a lot of emotion in his game. I think Davin, judging by his work with Del Potro, he's more of a long-term guy than Rashid. Seems like a guy who gets a lot out of somebody quickly, but then, you know, the relationship ends fairly quickly. Davin's had a long tenure with Del Potro, and so you feel like maybe he's a little more a little more level-headed day-to-day, can really build something with Dimitrov that lasts. You know, Davin has been it's mostly good things. You know, he seems like a good guy and a good coach and has had a lot of success, you know, with, you know, he didn't have a great game but had success with that game as a player. So I think that's – I think we can look for something better from Dimitrov with that.
Yeah, and I'm going to kind of close maybe the – we have one more topic I'd like to get to after all this, but, you know, looking ahead to this year, two players who I'm perhaps most curious of all where they end up, because I think they could end up almost anywhere is Jack Sock and Nick Kyrgios. And both of these two, you know, were certainly newsmakers in the past couple years for a variety of reasons. But, you know, anytime you see what Kyrgios brings, and I think it's great, you know, purely from a theater point of view that we're going to see him right away in his element in Australia. You know, I'm certainly with the crowd, I think, just, you know, really backing him just in spite of everything, you know, that happened last year. But I think Kyrgios in what was such a wild year, you know, starting from, you know, getting another signature win over Federer, a five-match point saving win in a big event, you know, to the self-inflicted turmoil that he put on him and everything in between, the crazy hair and the crazy shots. I mean, this guy is, whether you like him or not, is going to be one of these stories, I think, of this year. And I think, you know, for Sock, I'm kind of curious to see when he or if he really makes his next step, his next move, because, you know, really it's we've seen a lot of Americans come and go and kind of tantalize us with a few nice little runs or stretches, but really no one has supplanted John Isner as really the top guy in this, and that's a lot of credit to him. He's actually had one of his best years last year, but I think, you know, when you watch Sock, especially when you see him up close, as I did a couple times last year, he's got just an amazing game in his own right. And, you know, now has a few years of experience on tour. And I think both these two, really, to me, two of the more interesting guys for 2016. I don't know if you have anything to say about them or if there's any other players that kind of come to mind a little more off the radar.
Yeah, I'm curious about Sock too. He's got the big forehand, one of the biggest, and he's really quick, and he's got a good serve. Those are the things, you know, that you look at when you look at a young player that a guy needs to have. And so many guys who have a lot of things, they don't have that kind of athleticism, that kind of just natural power. He's got it. I think also he can get negative fast. I think it's more of a mental battle now. That's the next step, to stay in matches that might not be going his way. I don't know if I've seen, you know, he hasn't been great at that so far, but I think he started to believe in himself last year. I also like the fact that he's good on clay, so he's not going to disappear during part of the year like a lot of Americans can. So I think you could see something pretty good from him. I think with that, his raw skills, you know, that this guy, you know, his upside is pretty high. Kyrgios, you just don't know whether he's always going to sabotage himself. He hasn't shown a sign of changing much, despite all that's happened. He's even says going into the new year, he's not really planning to change. He's going to play his game. He likes to play on the edge. He likes to chat. He likes a lot of chatter. He likes to be emotionally engaged with the audience. And I just don't know whether that can help him, but it's also been his downfall. He gets distracted. Distracts himself and sort of blows up the match. I don't know whether I don't see that changing necessarily this year. Maybe in the long term, that'll change. But I don't know. I haven't seen a sign of it yet. It'll be definitely interesting to see what he can do if he can keep himself together mentally. He's definitely is a future slam winner.
Yep. Yeah. And otherwise we may be just seeing the beginning of the next Gael Monfils, really, in a way too.
Yeah, so maybe he's more on that trajectory. I don't know.
Yeah. Yes. Quite a trajectory there. So I wanted to close this with someone we will not be seeing in 2016, and on the tennis court, I should stress, not in any other meaning, but earlier this week, Robin Soderling called it a career. He is someone who we have not seen for a number of years, dealing with injury. He had mono for a while that really sidelined him, but I think he deserves a proper send-off, and we'll give it to him here. To me, what I would say about Soderling, he's one of the only guys who, over in this really era of dominance by Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Murray, he's really one of the few players who was able to take the bat out of their hand. And, of the matches that I remember of this era, a lot of them are going to involve, actually, of all players, Soderling. There's clearly the win over Rafa at Roland Garros in 2009, just, his ultimate masterpiece, really, which was just an exercise in, a devastating serve. Really, the forehand is the most impressive thing. It's just, I don't think anybody, with maybe the exception of Del Potro, just has this catapult swing that just can really just hit the ball by anyone, no matter how fast they are, how good of a defender they are. No one really had the game that it was a one-of-a-kind game. He was a one-of-a-kind player, I think. He obviously had, I think he got clearly on a lot of players' nerves with how he played. I think, he had a famous match with Nadal in Wimbledon in 2006, I believe, which stretched over a few days and really just kind of showed, I think, the playbook to getting under Rafa's skin in a way, and it was really perhaps a portent of things to come down the road. I saw Soderling, one time on a side court in Toronto after a rain delay, which forced matches, like really good matches, onto all the courts there, and to see the guy up close, to see the kind of shots, you can't even see the ball the instant it makes even close contact with him. So one of the players, I think, overall that we will remember besides the big four in this era, that's what I would really take away from Soderling's career.
Yeah, Soderling, I think he's really will be remembered for one match, for beating Nadal at the French Open. That just became the fact that nobody really thought Nadal. Nadal had never lost, and he wouldn't lose for another 5 years afterwards. That's where his name will be remembered in beating Rafa, and basically in sort of doing something that some people, it seemed at the time, was almost impossible, to really standing up to Rafa over 3 out of 5 sets on clay. He also, you kind of forget, or at least I forget, he also ended Federer's streak of 23 straight semifinals at Grand Slams. The following year, he made 2 French Opens finals in a row. He made it to the top 5. He was an interesting guy in that he started out as somebody, I think anybody who was watching maybe 12 years ago or so would have thought this guy's going to the top 10. I remember seeing him in the qualies at the U.S. Open. A big guy. He was bigger. You know, he was like 6'3", 6'4". But at that time, he was especially big. You know, the game got bigger with him. Just crunching balls in qualifying. You thought this guy is going somewhere, and then he stagnated for a long time. I think he was, he got frustrated easily. Didn't really have a complete game. Belted the ball, but the game went more to defense and speed, and those weren't his strong points. But I think the best thing about him was he really had no fear of the top guys. He lost to them most of the time because he wasn't as good. You know, he wasn't as polished. He missed more, but he never felt like he went out there he always felt like he went out there believing he could win and acting like he belonged with them. And the fact that he beat Nadal and, ended Nadal's streak at French and ended Federer's semifinal streak, that shows you that he did have that sort of, that ability to believe that he could beat anybody. And that's the one thing I think that was different from the other guys in that year, the guys who weren't in the Big Four, that he showed that he, if you do believe in believe you belong with them.
Compare him to a guy like Thomas Berdych, for example. Which is right. I think, a good, a classic case of, two players that have really, on the face of it, similar games, but look at really the results and really the confidence. And, I think that's what you're mentioning there. But
You can't. I mean, Berdych is the better player. He'll go down as the better player, and he was. But Söderling gave us, a couple thrills that Berdych hasn't managed to pull off.
Yeah, and I think it's worth closing on that point. Like I said, many, many preview elements continue for 2016, and we really get going fairly shortly with events in the Middle East, in India, and of course down in Australia. So set your alarm clocks if you're up for that, and the Australian Open will be here pretty much in about three four weeks. And with that, we will say goodbye to 2015. Welcome in 2016 tennis season. We'll be back, of course, Steve Tigner and Ed McGrogan here on the Tennis.com podcast.
You've been enjoying the Tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.